Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 6th of October, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 10 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Yes, we've made it through our first decade. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific, and finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to delve into the perennially thorny issue of religion. First, we're going to take a look at what the Catholic Church said last week about same-sex marriage. Were they able to contribute something useful to the debate? Well, we'll find out. Then I'm going to talk to Tanya Smith from the Atheist Foundation of Australia about probably the most exciting event for atheists in Australia that is likely to happen within our lifetimes. And it's coming very soon. Then in our movie review section, we'll review the new Australian film Van Diemen's Land. So stay tuned for all that and more here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last week or so. Our first news item comes from Portugal, where the Socialist Party government was returned to power last week, which is potentially good news for same-sex couples, because one of the campaign promises made by the re-elected Portuguese Prime Minister José Sócrates was to introduce same-sex marriage. Now, their neighbour, Spain, has had it since 2005, so hopefully that will have a positive influence on Portugal, and we'll see them getting marriage equality as well within the next year or so. Maybe they'll be the next European country to get same-sex marriage. We'll find out soon enough, I hope. Now, moving across the Atlantic to the United States, let's go to the state of Nevada, where last Thursday, the 1st of October, a domestic partnerships law came into effect. That law gives same-sex couples all the exact same rights and responsibilities that married couples have. They just can't call it marriage because in 2002, Nevada voted for a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. But fortunately, in May this year, the legislature voted to introduce these domestic partnerships. Well, actually, the governor vetoed it, but it then went back to the legislature and they got enough votes to override the veto. So kudos to the Nevada legislature for getting that through. And it's only been in force a few days, but apparently hundreds of couples have already registered their domestic partnerships. Now, just for your geographical information, dear listener, Nevada is the state just to the east of California, and its biggest and most famous city is, of course, Las Vegas. So you can probably expect to see a few Las Vegas same-sex weddings coming up. Except, of course, they won't actually be weddings. They'll be domestic partnership solemnization ceremonies. Interestingly, Nevada's new domestic partnership is also open to opposite-sex couples as well as same-sex couples. And also, those couples registering their relationship can choose whether to have a solemnization ceremony to go with it or not. Which is actually an issue that, strangely enough, is causing some controversy here in Australia at the moment. Currently in Australia, there are three jurisdictions that have some kind of civil union registration system for same-sex couples. They are Tasmania, Victoria, and the ACT. But when the couple goes along to register their relationship, they just sign the paperwork, basically. There's no kind of solemnization ceremony involved. And the stupid reason for this is just because the Labor Party thinks that a ceremony would be mimicking marriage. Now that, in my opinion, is just mean-spirited. Anyway, the Tasmanian government announced last week that it is going to introduce an optional solemnization ceremony presided over by a marriage celebrant to go along with the signing of the register. And they also want to introduce the same thing in the ACT, but it's a bit more complicated there. Tasmania can just go ahead and do it because Tasmania is a state, but the ACT is a territory and its laws can be overridden by the federal parliament. So the ACT last year, for example, proposed having solemnization ceremonies, but they were rejected by the federal government. And, well, they're now considering having another go at introducing ceremonies. Let's just see what happens. So it's good that in Tasmania, same-sex couples will soon have that option, but really, this is kind of a trivial issue, and the fact that this should cause controversy and should anger the Federal Labor Party, I don't know, I just don't understand. I mean, I think they are just mean and petty if they get upset and if they once again stop the ACT from introducing civil ceremonies. Now, let's return to the United States for a few moments because apart from what happened in Nevada there last week, things are starting to look interesting in the US on the LGBT rights front, especially over the next few weeks. Because next Sunday, October the 11th, is going to see the National Equality March in Washington, D.C. Thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of LGBT activists from all over the United States are going to converge on the national capital to demand equality. The purpose of the march is, and I quote, "to demand equal protection in all matters governed by civil law in all 50 states. Now." The march itself will take place on Sunday afternoon, but they are planning a whole lot of other events during the weekend, so if you're going to be anywhere around Washington, D.C. this coming weekend, why not pop on down? It should be a pretty fun and interesting event, I reckon. There have actually been four previous LGBT marches on Washington, D.C. in 1979, 1987, 1993, and also in the year 2000. So this one will actually be the fifth. There has also been a little bit of controversy about this march. Some commentators said it wasn't really a grassroots movement. Some said it's all been decided very hastily and they haven't had enough time to prepare to do it well. Some also question whether marches on Washington actually ever achieve anything and whether they're an effective use of resources. I don't know. I think that at the very least they create visibility. Hopefully they also get the attention of the politicians. And I think that these kinds of mass rallies do create very visible historic events that are remembered for a long time and do mark certain points in history and reflect the times in which they occur. Anyway, whether you agree or disagree, the 2009 March is definitely going ahead, and I say good luck to them. I hope it all goes really well, and I hope the politicians sit up and take notice. And dear listener, no doubt we'll be reporting on the day's events right here in the next episode of Reality Check. Now, another major event related to LGBT rights that's coming up in the US very soon is the two referenda in the states of Maine and Washington due to take place on November 3rd. In Maine, they're going to vote on same-sex marriage. The legislature there passed a law to allow same-sex marriage back in May, and that law would have come into effect in September, except that the opponents of same-sex marriage managed to gather enough signatures to get what they call a people's veto onto the ballot. So now the issue is going to be put to a referendum. It's almost an exact rerun of what happened in California last year, even to the point that the marriage equality opponents are running TV ads in Maine using the exact same footage they used in California to defeat marriage equality there. Anyway, let's just hope that this time they won't be successful. But the TV ad debates are certainly heating up these days on both sides, and I expect, well, we'll continue to heat up as November the 3rd approaches. And I did see last week that Nate Silver, who's a famous statistician who likes to predict election outcomes, and in the US elections last November, correctly predicted the winners in 49 out of 50 states, apparently. He's predicting that our side, the marriage equality side, will win with 56.5% of the vote. So, fingers crossed, let's hope that he's right. Now, I also mentioned Washington, the state of Washington, and over there, they're going to have a similar ballot on November the 3rd, but it won't be strictly about marriage, it will be about domestic partnerships, what they're calling everything but marriage. They got these state-registered domestic partnerships for same-sex couples back in 2007, but with limited rights. Then, in April this year, the legislature voted to extend those rights and make them the same as the rights of a married couple. So that's why they're calling this the Everything But Marriage referendum, because the domestic partnerships have all the rights of marriage, just not the name, basically. But just like what's happening in Maine, the opponents got enough signatures to get the issue put on that ballot on November the 3rd. So they're going to vote on that issue in Washington in a few weeks as well as in Maine. Anyway, it should be an interesting few weeks as the campaigns heat up on both sides of the debate and on both sides of the country, actually, in Washington on the west and Maine on the east coast. And we will, of course, keep you informed here on Reality Check of any developments as they arise. All right, let's take a break now and listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll see just what exactly Catholic Cardinal George Pell had to say last week about same-sex marriage and whether what he said had any merit or not. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Gracias a la Vida by Mercedes Sosa, the legendary singer from Argentina who just unfortunately died on Sunday, 2 days ago. I thought I'd play that song as a homage to her. As well as having an impressive voice, she was also pretty active in fighting for human rights in Latin America, particularly during the dictatorships in South America during the 70s and 80s, particularly in Argentina. Anyway, I'm not a huge fan of her music, but my partner Isidro is, so that one goes out to you, mon amour. Okay, now, let's get into religion. Now, for this segment, we're going to take a look at the latest contribution from the Catholic Church on the issue of same-sex marriage. Now, you may remember that in June this year, Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young from South Australia introduced into the Senate the Marriage Equality Amendment Bill, which, if passed, would amend the Marriage Act to allow same-sex couples to marry. That bill was then referred to a Senate committee for inquiry, and during the months of July and August, that committee received thousands of submissions, over 10,000 in fact, from various groups and individuals. The committee is now sifting through all those submissions and will report back to Parliament in late November. But what happened last week was that some of the main submissions from a number of prominent groups were made public on the Senate website. And amongst those submissions made public was one by the Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, Cardinal George Pell. And I was curious to see what he had to say. Because whether we like it or not, what he says about same-sex marriage is unfortunately relevant because a lot of people listen to him. He's the leader of the Catholic Church in Australia, which is Australia's largest single religious grouping. About 5 million people in Australia call themselves Catholic. That's about a quarter of the population. So it is interesting to know what their leader has to say on the issue. But, I mean, what could he have to say? He's a Catholic cardinal, a religious figure. So what could he have to say about the secular institution of civil marriage? What insights could he possibly contribute? Well, as it turns out, none. He offers absolutely no insights, except, in my opinion, for an insight into his own ignorance and arrogance. His submission is a bizarre series of falsehoods, logical fallacies, and non sequiturs. All, of course, dressed up to sound really warm and compassionate and caring. So I thought that on Reality Check today, we'd have a critical look at George Pell's submission and see in a bit more detail where the problems lie. Now, the first comment I want to make is this, and that is that we're in the field of public discourse, and specifically we're talking about rights. What rights and freedoms should people in society have? And whether certain people should be denied those rights. So that's a pretty important issue. In fact, it's one of the most important issues that any society has to decide. And it's generally accepted that in the field of public discourse, no matter what your personal moral or religious beliefs are, no matter what your personal idea of the good life is, in public discourse, when you're trying to put your argument forward to other people, to the rest of society, you need to stick to logical and rational arguments based in reality. Because they're the only kinds of arguments that have the possibility of convincing everyone and being agreed upon by everyone. So if you're arguing with Catholics and Buddhists and Muslims and atheists, you can't use your personal religious belief as a basis for arguing to restrict somebody else's rights. You can't argue, for example, that no one should be allowed to wear red hats on Tuesday because if they do, Lord Jupiter will get angry. Well, you can argue that if you want, but you can't expect to convince anyone else because they don't believe in Lord Jupiter. So if you want to convince other people, you have to make a rational, non-religious argument. that everyone could agree with. And if you happen to be in a position of power and you just decide to go ahead anyway and enforce the ban on red hats on Tuesday just because you think it's a good idea and apply it to everyone, then what you can expect is resentment from people enforced to conform to a religious belief they don't share. And I think that essentially that's what George Pell tries to do in his submission to the Senate inquiry. He argues that LGBT people should be denied basic civil rights, not for any rational, logical reason that everyone could agree with, but simply based on his personal religious belief. Now, I'd also just like to make it very clear the context in which this Senate inquiry is happening. Late last year, the federal government amended 85 laws so that same-sex couples in Australia now have all the same rights and responsibilities of unmarried opposite-sex couples, that is, de facto couples, which are the same rights and responsibilities as married couples. So if you live together as a couple for a certain period of time, you will automatically acquire all the rights and responsibilities of a married couple. So the argument now is not about the rights and responsibilities of marriage. We've already got those. It's just really about the word. Should same-sex couples be able to call their legal relationship a marriage or not? That's it. That's the only question that's in dispute. So given that that's the context we're talking about, let's see what Cardinal Pell has to say on the matter. Well, needless to say, he says straight out in his first paragraph that he opposes opening marriage to same-sex couples. And his first factual error comes in the second line of his submission. Now, don't panic, dear listener, his submission actually goes on for 6 pages, but I'm not going to go through it line by line. I'll just be focusing on his most egregious errors of logic. Anyway, back to that second line, in which he defines marriage as, and I quote, a natural institution between a man and a woman, end quote. Now, this is simply not true. Marriage is not natural. It's not something that occurs in nature. Civil marriage is a human legal construction. So that is wrong to say that marriage is a natural institution. So a major stumble there by Cardinal Pell at the very first hurdle. Now, in a nutshell, to save you all the nitty-gritty and all the nasty details, George Pell bases his opposition to same-sex marriage on the notion that marriage is essentially about procreation, and therefore only two people capable of producing children between themselves should be able to get married. Now, there is, of course, an obvious problem with that proposition. Many men and women are not capable of producing children between themselves. They are infertile. Many also have no desire to do so. And yet Cardinal Pell says explicitly that they should be allowed to get married anyway. It's just the same-sex couples who shouldn't be able to. So how can he justify that? Well, to tell you the truth, I don't know. I'll read you the paragraph where he apparently justifies that, but, well, I'll read it and see if you can make any head or tail of it. He says, and I quote, "The definition of marriage as an inherently procreative community does not exclude heterosexual married couples who cannot have children for reasons of age or infertility. They are still married because their sexual union is naturally designed to give life, even if it cannot give life at a particular point in time or ever. Marriage between a man and a woman always has an inherent capacity for the generation of children, whether that capacity is actualized or not." End quote. Now, did you understand that? A man and a woman always have a capacity to generate children, even if they never can. Well, I wish we could have George Pell here in the studio to ask him exactly what he means and what relevance that has to civil marriage. But unfortunately, good old George never allows himself to get into situations where he can be questioned about his pronouncements. He just pronounces, and people are supposed to pay attention. And unfortunately, a lot of them do pay attention. Anyway, let me move on to a couple more fundamental problems with his argument. At several times during his submission, he says, and I quote, "The child should always be seen as a gift." Now, that's an interesting choice of words there. And also interesting because George Pell, fully aware that he's entering into public discourse here and knowing that the rules of public discourse about not using your religious beliefs, well, he's very careful not to mention God or Jesus or Mary or any of the other Catholic deities in his submission. Yet, describing a child as a gift begs the question, a gift from whom? Who's the giver? Well, let's see. And I'm just guessing wildly here. Maybe from the stork, you know, the stork that brings you the babies. Maybe that's the one who gives the gift. Oh no, but wait, he's a Catholic. So maybe it's a gift from Saint Gerard. He's the patron saint of fertility, pregnancy and motherhood. Maybe he's the gift giver. Or maybe it's one of the virgins, like Our Lady of Guadalupe, perhaps, or Our Lady of Fatima. I mean, they're always helpful for fertility issues. Well, unfortunately, Cardinal Pell doesn't mention who the giver of the gift is. But I think we can safely assume that said giver is one of the supernatural beings from the Catholic pantheon. And therefore, talking about children as gifts is unacceptable in public discourse. It's injecting his own religious beliefs into the arguments he's making. Arguments ultimately designed to deny civil rights to certain people. Now, you wouldn't like it if someone did that to you, would you, George? No, I didn't think so. So why do you do it to others? Haven't you heard of something called the Golden Rule? Anyway, later in his submission, the good cardinal makes the statement that has caused probably the most controversy. The cardinal here is talking about what happens when we permit same-sex relationships to mimic, his word, to mimic marriage. He says, and I quote, "Instead of seeing children principally as gifts created in love, we begin to perceive them as commodities to satisfy adult desires." In other words, same-sex couples see children differently from opposite-sex couples. They see them as commodities. Oh, those same-sex couples, they're so selfish, aren't they? They just want children as the latest fashion accessory. You know, all those gay men who live in Paran and they want their Saab and they want their golden retriever. And guess what? This year it's all the rage to have a baby. And why don't we just pick one up from Africa like Bruno did? And we could even call it a gaby like he did. Oh, that's a great idea. And then, well, I mean, then next year when babies are like so passé, we'll just give it away. And we'll get a brand new Tamagotchi because they'll be totally back in fashion by then. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe George Pell doesn't exactly say that, but that's certainly the type of stereotype that he's implying. Now, let me try to deal with this rationally. Basically, George, you are just factually wrong. First of all, children are not gifts. Maybe you missed that day in Year 9 science class, but children are formed when a sperm fuses with an egg. And that can happen in the uterus from a man ejaculating into a woman's vagina. And it can also happen in other ways. And guess what? It doesn't make any difference to the child. A child is still just as likely to be loved and cared for, no matter how he or she is conceived. And also, George, same-sex couples don't regard children as commodities. They regard children in the same way that other couples regard children, as something very, very special and a major factor in giving meaning to their life. And also, George, same-sex couples will never have children by accident, as opposite-sex couples might. They'll never have an unwanted pregnancy. Generally, children of same-sex couples are very planned, very wanted, and very loved. Nor do same-sex couples just blindly and unquestioningly follow the life path of so many opposite-sex couples who just finish school, get a job, get married, have babies without even thinking about it, just because it's what everyone does. Same-sex couples generally have to think a lot more about having children and go into it with their eyes fully open. But having said all this, it's not even relevant to the issue at hand, which is civil marriage. And actually, George Pell's entire submission completely misses this point. Because we're not even talking about children here. Children are irrelevant. We're talking about civil marriage, a legal union between two consenting adults. The Marriage Act doesn't stipulate that couples must intend to have children or must be proven fertile. It doesn't mention children in any relevant sense at all. So bringing the issue of children into the debate is a red herring. And that's what George Pell's entire argument is based on. And also, look around you, George. Same-sex couples already have children. They're already having them, and they're already raising them, and they've been doing so for years and will continue to do so. Maybe they got them from a previous marriage, maybe they adopted them, maybe they got a friend to donate sperm. It doesn't matter. And whether those couples are allowed to get married or not is not going to affect whether they're going to continue to have children or not. So the whole issue of children is completely irrelevant. And so in the end, George, you haven't even touched the real issue here, the only relevant issue here, which is this. When a same-sex couple, let's say Susan and Maria, when Susan and Maria rock up at the registry office asking for a civil marriage, what possible reason do you have to exclude them? What harm would be done if they got married? If you offer civil marriage to other couples, you're going to need a pretty good reason to justify discriminating against Susan and Maria when they ask for the same thing. And George Pell has given absolutely no reason to exclude them, because actually there is no reason. And when people like George Pell use their political power based on their own personal beliefs about the supernatural to influence the state to deny access to a civil institution to LGBT people, well, it leaves a really nasty taste in the mouth of the people on the receiving end. And if you wonder why people don't like you, George, that's why. It's not because you dress up in funny clothes and make long, boring speeches and believe lots of really bizarre nonsense. It's because you use your power to legally and socially repress other people. And we don't like that at all. All right, enough said on George Pell. Let's listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll hear an interview with Tanya Smith about an extremely exciting atheist conference coming up in Melbourne in just a few months from now. Believe me, when you hear the lineup of who's going to be there, you will not want to miss it.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Paz en Casa by the Tribalistas from Brazil. Now, what would you say if I told you that you had the chance to see Richard Dawkins speak live? Well, as he is arguably the world's most famous skeptic, atheist, and evolutionary biologist, you'd probably say, cool, yeah, count me in. And what if I added that at the same time you would also get to see Peter Singer, the ethicist described by the New Yorker as the world's most influential living philosopher, and by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. And if I also happened to mention that you would also get to see P.Z. Myers, the evolutionary biologist who is also the writer of the world's most popular science blog, Pharyngula. And that you would also get to see Dan Barker, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation and one of the most prominent atheist activists in the United States. And as well as all those, you'd also get to see Philip Adams, Taslima Nasreen, A.C. Grayling, Catherine Devaney, Robin Williams, and a host of other atheist and skeptical luminaries. What would you say? Well, you'd probably be wetting your pants with excitement and desperately screaming at me to tell you where you can get the tickets. Well, dear listener, I'm delighted to report that this hypothetical situation with which I have just presented you is not actually hypothetical. It's a reality because they are just some of the speakers participating in the 2010 Global Atheist Conference coming up in March right here in Melbourne. Now, they just launched their website and started selling tickets last week, and I immediately bought my ticket and said I need to get someone on the show to talk about this. So luckily, Tanya Smith from the Atheist Foundation of Australia was able to come into the studio and have a little chat. And it's that chat that we're going to listen to right now. Okay, I'm joined in the studio now by Tanya Smith, the coordinator of the Global Atheist Convention 2010. Welcome to Reality Check, Tanya.
Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Now, just before we get into the details of the convention, can you just tell us a bit about yourself and your involvement with the Atheist Federation, I think, or Foundation?
Foundation. Sure. Well, I'm on a committee, and we're all a volunteer committee, by the way, and I'm one of the coordinators of the Global Atheist Convention, so we're just responsible for pulling it all together and making sure it runs smoothly next year. I'm also on the public relations team for the Atheist Foundation.
Okay, excellent. And how long have you been an atheist?
Well, I think I've really been an atheist my whole life. I was always one of those people who wanted to know how things worked and why, and it was never good enough for me when people just said, well, that's how it is. So, you know, probably since around about the age of 7 when I figured out what religion was, I've been an atheist. And indeed, we had a neighbourhood child who asked me if I believed in God, and I said no. And they said, well, you're going to die before you're 21. And I'm very pleased to report that hasn't actually happened.
I'm pleased about that too. All right, okay, Tanya, so I got you in today to talk about this very exciting Global Atheist Conference next year, or convention. Can you tell us about that? Spill the beans.
Absolutely. Look, it's going to be a fantastic event. It's in March 2010 in Melbourne, and I really hope everyone who's interested in this topic will come along. Anyone who's concerned about the impact that religion has on our society, you know, really should come along. We have a range of fantastic speakers. We have Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion and also The Greatest Show on Earth. We've got Catherine Devaney. She's a comedian and a regular writer for The Age. Huge range. P.Z. Myers, Philip Adams, Peter Singer, A.C. Grayling, Dan Barker. He's an American. He's a former evangelical preacher and is now the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Yeah, no, that's great that you're getting him and all the others. For people who don't know, Dan Barker and his partner, Annie Laurie Gaylor, present Free Thought Radio, which is a great podcast that I listen to regularly, and people can check out at the, what are they called? The Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is at ffrf.org. But yeah, so Dan Barker's a great guest, but I mean, what a fantastic lineup.
Yeah, we're absolutely thrilled.
I reckon when people find out who's going to be there, I reckon that this conference is going to go off.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just amazing the people who you're going to get, who we're going to get the opportunity to see. As soon as I saw the webpage and saw who was going to be there, I bought my tickets. I said to myself, if I miss this, I'll kick myself.
Look, so. I think that's right. You know, something of this size and scale has never been done in Australia before, and I don't know, you know, if or when it will ever be done again. So I think it really is a fantastic opportunity for atheists, for other like-minded people to get together and hear from some remarkable speakers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in my memory, I can't remember anything this big and this major being done specifically with these kinds of speakers, specifically on the topic of atheism. It's really a...
No, there really hasn't been anything like this, so it's going to be fantastic, and I think you're right, people should kick themselves if they miss it.
Yeah, okay, so having said that... where can people go to get tickets?
Well, the convention website is atheistconvention.org.au. It's got all the information about the program, the speakers, the tickets, everything you need to know is there.
That's atheistconvention.org.au. So definitely, if this is something that sounds like it could be right up your alley, go to the website and probably I'd say get your tickets sooner rather than later, because I suspect with a lineup like this, it's probably an event that will sell out probably fairly quickly. But you've just launched it last week, wasn't
it? That's right. The official launch was last week and the ticket sales are going well, so we're very pleased.
Yeah, and so just a reminder, that's going to be the 12th to the 14th of March next year, 2010, here in Melbourne. Now, Tanya, just coming back to the issue of atheism, what drove you, or what was the inspiration in organising this conference?
Look, I think this is a great opportunity for the atheists and other like-minded people to get together and hear from these speakers, but it's going to raise awareness of atheism, and I think that's quite important because it's a very misunderstood word, and it's going to demonstrate to political and religious leaders that atheists are active, that they vote, and they're not willing to let important social issues be hijacked by rational thought anymore. You know, on a slightly less serious note, we've got great range of speakers, fantastic entertainment for the Saturday night dinner, so we're going to have a good time.
Yeah, I think it is... what would be the word? Helpful? Or it's a good thing that people, high-profile people, kind of come out of the closet as atheists? Because, I mean, there is kind of a similarity here to the gay or lesbian situation, that there is a certain stigma sometimes associated with declaring yourself an atheist. And I think when the general public see people openly declaring themselves as atheists, I think that can be encouraging for a lot of people who maybe have been timid until now to call themselves atheists or to think about how they might call themselves.
Look, I think that's right. It's a very misunderstood term. You know, a lot of people think, you know, we want to abolish religion, or we hate everybody who's religious, or atheists have got no moral guidance or anything like that. And none of that is correct. You know, atheism is the acceptance that there is no credible evidence of any god or the supernatural. So if you don't believe in flying pigs or the ancient Roman gods or the Hindu gods, you know, why would you believe in a Christian god or a Jewish god or an Islamic god when there's no credible evidence for any of them? You know, an atheist isn't going to tell you 100% definitively there is no God. An atheist is going to tell you there is no evidence of a God. So it's a very rational and very consistent approach to life that just says, well, show me the evidence. If you can show me the evidence, then let's talk. But until then, you know, I'm not really all that interested.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is a perfectly rational approach. And it is strange how a lot of people interpret the term atheist as somehow being aggressive, when all we're really saying is, well, we just don't believe. We haven't seen the evidence to convince us, and that's it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the belief word is an interesting one, because we quite often get people asking, you know, well, you've don't believe there's a God. I believe there's a God. You know, why is your belief any better than mine? But atheism is not a religion. It's not a belief. It is a rational and consistent approach. It says, well, the evidence gets you this far. If you want to believe in something, you've got to make this leap of faith and go further. And the atheist says, well, it's okay that I don't know everything. It's okay that we haven't got all the answers to how the world came about and why things happen. Things just happen. That's okay. We don't need to create something to fill the void. And I can understand that people get comfort from filling that void and they might like to think that there's a reason for things, but, you know, finding comfort in something doesn't make it true.
Exactly. Yep, I couldn't have put it better myself. And it is also interesting how often hearing stories, like I often hear these stories on that Dan Barker's radio podcast, the Freethought radio show, of people who were religious and became atheists and how much comfort that gave them. The fact that of throwing away these religious beliefs and how atheism, kind of seeing things as they really are, that gave them comfort.
Yeah, look, I think that makes a lot of sense because there's a great intellectual freedom in being an atheist because you know, there's no rules that are being handed to you. There's no things that you must do to try and get yourself into some theoretical heaven or something like that. You say, well, this is my life. I only have one of them. I'm going to try and do the best that I can. And all that stuff about atheists not having morals and all that sort of stuff is complete rubbish because, you know, as an example, you know, do what I like to do. I have a career. I do not-for-profit work. I have a good relationship with my partner. You know, I have find in life the things that give me value. And other people find that too. You just don't need it handed to you by an old book.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that's a point that Richard Dawkins often makes as well, that once you get rid of that idea that, well, this is just a kind of preliminary stage for the afterlife, once you kind of throw that out, then it's like, well, this is probably all I've got. I should make the most of every moment.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, when you get to the end of your life, you want to look back and be proud of the things that you've achieved and the relationships you've had with other people and the impact that you've had on society. It's not all about where you're going next because, you know, really, none of us really know.
Exactly. That's it. None of us know. Even though a lot of people say they know and try to impose that their own beliefs on other people based on that, the truth is none of us know.
No, look, that's definitely true. And if you think about all the multitude of religions out there, the thousands of things that people have believed and worshipped over the course of human history, a very large proportion of them must be wrong because there's a whole lot of people who've contradicted themselves. And so, you know, you'll find the most fundamental believers, you know, on any side of any religion you can come up with, but, you know, they all think everybody else is wrong. Yeah. So someone's got to be wrong.
That's right. There's a funny, I can't remember it very well, there's a funny South Park episode on that where they die and get to heaven and it's kind of like it's suddenly revealed, oh, well, who was right? Oh, it was the Mormons. Congratulations. You're the lucky ones.
There's a Rowan Atkinson sketch along the same lines. You go, Christians to the left. Sorry. The Jews were right.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's funny. But it's also, I mean, you touched on that a little while ago, the point that I think another one that Richard Dawkins and James Randi make a lot, that that everybody is an atheist to some extent in that everybody has certain gods that they don't believe in. People don't believe in Thor now. People don't believe in Zeus and Aphrodite and whatever. And so, yeah, it's not something that it's something that everyone can relate to a certain extent.
Well, that's right. There's a great quote, you know, we are all atheists. I just believe in one fewer God than you do. How do you pick? There's thousands of them out there. And, you know, the religion that people have is almost exclusively based on the religion that they were brought up in. We have Christian countries, Muslim countries, Eastern Orthodox countries, because most people believe what they're told from the time that they're born. And there's a very good evolutionary reason for this, which Richard Dawkins talks about in The God Delusion. You know, when over time humans have evolved and people listen to their elders, they learn from their elders, you know, don't eat those berries, don't play with those lions, don't fall off the cliff, all these sorts of things. So we are programmed, for perfectly logical reasons, to believe what our parents and indeed the senior members of our society tell us. That's great, but it's completely hijacked by religion because they tell you things that cannot be proved and they embed them in your mind, and so that people find it very, very hard to step away from that when they're older.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's also interesting this idea that most people, probably 99% of people, just follow the religion that they, that their parents were, that they were brought up in. And that's always something that's always kind of struck me as when that is pointed out to people, and when the existence of other religions are pointed out to people, doesn't that make them question? Doesn't that make them kind of realize that, well, it's just, was just completely arbitrary that I was born into a Mormon family or a Hindu family or whatever. So maybe my faith is maybe not the right one. I don't know. It always never ceases to amaze me that people don't question that.
Yeah. I think that's right. And human beings are very good at blocking out things that they impact on deeper. These are emotional beliefs. These aren't rational beliefs. You know, these are embedded into children often when they're quite young, you know, particularly with some pretty horrible things about the fear of hell and all this sort of stuff if you don't believe. And so if that's embedded into you as a young child and you just don't think about questioning it. It's actually quite rare. We live in a society that is extremely respectful of religion. And look, you know, atheists certainly don't want to abolish religion. We promote freedom of thought. You can believe in fluffy pink elephants for all I care. What atheists care about is when you take those beliefs and you try to impose them on social attitudes and legislation that affects everybody.
Yeah, well, here. That would be my my main objection to most organized religions as well. When they can believe what they want, but it's when they try to impose, normally using the state, using legislation to impose their own beliefs about the good life or reality or whatever on other people, that's when that is unacceptable, and that's when you get conflicts arising, when people try to impose their beliefs on others.
Look, I think that's right. I mean, you think about some of the, you know, considered to be controversial social issues, abortion rights, voluntary euthanasia, same-sex marriage, stem cell research. I'm not going to say every single person who opposes those things is religious, but there's certainly very powerful, well-organized religious lobby groups against those kinds of issues. And those are issues that affect everybody.
Yeah, and they're perfect examples of that situation where people are simply denying rights to other people purely based on their own religious beliefs, their own beliefs about how the world is.
And don't forget that religious lobby groups are extremely well-funded, well-organized, and indeed taxpayer-supported in this country. So, you know, I'm a taxpayer. Anyone out there who's a taxpayer, your taxes are supporting religious lobby groups, and I personally find that very offensive.
Now, can we just come back to one question? Because it is a question that comes up a lot, and that is the question of, if you're an atheist, how can you have morals? What's your answer to that one?
Well, it's an interesting one because it does come up quite a lot, but it's actually quite simple. It all comes back to the evolutionary process. Humans, and indeed most other animals as well, develop a social structure, and they develop a social structure because it is stable. None of us really wants to live in a society where people are just all wantonly going around murdering and stealing things. It's not stable, and it's not sensible, and it's not healthy for us and indeed for our genes, which is all about, you know, we're all designed to perpetuate our genes down the evolutionary process. So I don't believe in any God. And I have what I would consider a reasonably normal set of contemporary morals. So it's actually quite simple. And interestingly, if you have a look at the studies on ethical questions posed to people across different religions and people who are completely non-believers, you get very similar responses. Mm-hmm. There's no particular distinction between atheists, non-believers, religious people, or indeed between the different types of religions. Human beings have evolved social structures that are stable and that last and perpetuate the species. Mm-hmm. And you don't need religion to do that.
No, well, that's right. And, you know, I've heard the argument that the fact that atheists choose to act morally, even if they, you know, they believe that there's not going to be, they're not going to be punished by a God in the sky, that somehow there's an argument to say that that's even more moral. If you believe that you're completely free to decide good or evil and you act morally, which, of course, most people do.
Look, you know, think about some of the things that people find most offensive, you know, violent assault, child abuse, things like that. You know, does someone need to tell you that that's wrong?
Do you
not know that simply by being a human and being part of a society? I don't want to live in a society like that. I want to get to the end of my life and look back and be proud of the things that I've done. I mean, I'm not perfect. Nobody is. But that's what I want. And I, you know, don't need the promise of an afterlife to want that.
Now, I would want to ask you one more question, and that is, I see that the title of the convention next year is The Rise of Atheism. What are you referring to there?
Look, I think the rise of atheism is reflective of the mood in democratic societies. You know, over time, slowly, we are becoming more secular. And I think the rise of atheism is also reflective of what we hope to achieve through this convention. You know, we want to live in a society where social attitudes and legislation are shaped by rational thought and evidence, not people's interpretation of old books. So it's both reflective of where we are and where we hope to be.
All right, Tanya, any final comments from you?
Look, I'd just like to encourage everyone who recognises that religion has got too much power and influence in our society to come along to the Global Atheist Convention. It's really hard to make a difference as an individual, but as part of a group, I think we can.
I think we can too. I hope we can. Well, Tanya Smith, thank you very, very much for talking to us here at Reality Check. It sounds like a very, very exciting convention, and hopefully a lot of our listeners will be able to attend.
Absolutely, anytime.
So that was my chat there with Tanya Smith from the Atheist Foundation of Australia. And once again, if you want to check out some information about the Global Atheist Convention or get your tickets, just visit atheistconvention.org.au. And a few of the people who are going to speak at the convention are actually fellow podcasters. You can, for example, find Philip Adams presenting Late Night Live every weeknight here on Radio National in Australia, which is also available as a podcast, as is The Science Show, also on Radio National, presented by Robin Williams. Kylie Sturgis from the Skeptic Zone podcast will also be at the convention, and I already mentioned Dan Barker's weekly radio show and podcast, Freethought Radio. So if you're into podcasting, they're all good podcasts to check out. Now, finally, before we get into our final song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please do send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. And you can also visit our webpage too, if you like. That's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day with Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, here on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. To find podcasts of our previous shows, just go to the Reality Check website. That's realitycheckonline.net. And the song you just heard there was Life by none other than Ricky Martin from Puerto Rico. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and our movie up for review this week is the new Australian film Van Diemen's Land. Van Diemen's Land was the original name given by the Europeans to the island of Tasmania. Actually, the name of the colony wasn't officially changed to Tasmania until 1856. Anyway, the movie is set in the year 1822 and tells the story of 8 Irish, English and Scottish convicts who escape from the Sarah Island penal colony in Macquarie Harbour on the west coast of Tasmania. This plot is actually based on the true story of one of Australia's most notorious convicts, Irishman Alexander Pearce. Of course, once the men escape from the penal station, they find themselves free, but also in the middle of the wild forests of Western Tasmania, with very few provisions. Their original euphoria at no longer being prisoners fairly quickly turns into despair as they realise the seriousness of their situation. They want to get to Hobart, but have no idea where they are. The days pass by as they wade through freezing rivers and trudge through thick forests and over mountains, in the snow and rain. Eventually, their food runs out, and that's when the story turns very grim indeed. Now, if you haven't heard anything about the film or the real-life story of Alexander Pierce, I'm not going to tell you what happens. I'll just say this much. Van Diemen's Land is not a nice, fun Friday night popcorn movie. It's bleak, it's grim, and I have to say it contains some of the most graphic and disturbing violence I've seen in a movie in quite a while. Now, that said, it certainly looks great. The cinematography is stunning. The whole film is shot in kind of washed out bluish grey tones, and the slow sweeping shots of the impenetrable Tasmanian wilderness are breathtakingly beautiful and very dramatic, and the music that goes with them really creates an atmosphere of tense foreboding. The close-ups of the men's faces as they're eating or contemplating their situation are really stunning to look at as well. The main problem, though, in my opinion, is that for a film with so much dramatic potential, and you don't really get much more dramatic potential than this, the filmmaker falls short because we never really get to know the characters. First of all, we have very little background story about each man. And secondly, because there are eight of them and they're all moving through the forest together and they're all dressed in convict rags and they all very quickly start growing beards and looking very bedraggled, it's actually quite hard to tell them apart and remember who's who. So I found that as I didn't really know the characters, I couldn't feel that dramatically involved when horrific things started to happen to them. Also, from the little that we do learn about them, most of them don't seem like very appealing people anyway, so it's kind of hard to relate to them. By the end of the movie, I felt like I just sat through 100 minutes of extremely bleak violence without much of a payoff. Now, a couple more interesting observations about the movie. One is that a lot of the dialogue is actually in Irish Gaelic. Because a few of the prisoners are from Ireland, that's the language they use to speak to each other. So it's nice to see that attention to detail and realism, rather than having everything entirely in English, just to appeal to an English-speaking audience. The other interesting element in the film is the love story between two of the convicts. This is never referred to explicitly, but is alluded to several times, and apparently is based on fact. Two of the convicts, the two leaders, basically, Robert Greenhill and Matthew Travers, had what was considered an unusually close relationship. Now, this is dealt with quite subtly in the film, and so I do wonder if most moviegoers will pick up on it. And my final comment about Van Diemen's Land, the movie, is that it's interesting how barren and inhospitable the Australian bush can be for Europeans lost in it. They just can't find anything to eat. In the movie, they don't even try to hunt or fish, and they never seem to encounter any wildlife either. And yet it's interesting to think that even though it's so inhospitable for the Europeans, the Tasmanian Aborigines lived there for thousands of years, and they survived for thousands of years. So obviously it's not impossible to survive in the bush without food. I guess you just have to know how to find it or catch it. And of course, the saddest thing about the Tasmanian Aborigines is that after surviving there for thousands of years, they were all completely wiped out very soon after European colonization. The last full-blooded Tasmanian Aborigine died in 1876. All Tasmanian Aboriginal languages and pretty much all their culture has been lost, obliterated wiped off the face of the earth, a truly tragic chapter in the history of humanity. Anyway, just an observation that came to mind as I was watching the movie. Even though the convicts never encounter any Aborigines during their peregrinations. Probably because even then, as early as 1822, actually most of the Tasmanian Aborigines had already been killed. Anyway, as for the movie, I would say that if you're in the mood for something oppressively bleak and cheerless and extremely violent, then check it out. Otherwise, you may be better off going and checking out the cute little guinea pigs in G-Force or something like that. Or maybe, better still, stay at home and hire a DVD. And that brings us to the end of the 10th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 11. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.